The title of my sermon this morning is Why a Plurality? I'm talking about elders. We're specifically walking through a four-part series on eldership, because at the end of this four-part series, we'll be voting to call two men to join me in the eldership. And so the question could be, why should we have a plurality of leaders or a plurality of elders? Last week we talked about what is an elder? An elder is one that comes from among us, who is a shepherd, who is an overseer, who leads, guides, directs in the spiritual realm of your lives. But why have a plurality? To answer the question, I would say, plainly, because Jesus said so. I love that. Whenever you got one of those kind of things, you know, where it's like, God said so. It's always the answer to that very good question. The long answer, I guess, let's give you the long answer to that. And it would be because Jesus both taught and used a plurality himself. He could have set one person over the church of moving forward. As a matter of fact, an entire group of people, one of the largest religions in the world, the Roman Catholic tradition, holds the idea that Christ did set one person over it all, and it was Peter. That's not true. When famously Jesus was asking the disciples, all 12 of them, who do people say that I am? Some say Elijah, some say... And Peter stands up as the bold, brash individual that he is, and he says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus has a pun of sorts, and he says, Petros, Peter, little rock, upon this rock, this big rock, the rock of your confession, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And the reason why we know this, that there's a plurality, is because when Christ came to the earth, he used a plurality to start the church. And then those men understood that this is how church is supposed to operate. It's supposed to operate under the guise of a multiplicity of elders, a plurality. Go into every town and raise up elders for the church. I want us to do something very, very interesting this morning. And I want us to have as an outline each and every one of the 12 disciples. I want us to consider, if we can get through them all in the short time allotted to us, just a quick character sketch, so to speak, of who it was that Christ called to be the first leaders of his church, the apostles. I think by doing this, by looking at least quickly, getting a snapshot of these individuals, we will see that eldership or being a pastor is not, it's not what our current American Christian culture would express. So, let's dive in. If you want to, turn with me to John 12. We'll actually read that in just a moment, because we're going to start with the worst of the elders, or the worst of the disciples, the worst of the apostles, the worst of these. And the reason why I'm taking this liberty of calling the disciples elders and the apostles elders is because that's what Peter did. We saw that last week. He says, I, a fellow elder. So here he equates himself to that kind of level. And so that's why I'm kind of taking this liberty, as it were, to call these these first initial church leaders, somewhat like elders. So first we'll take a look at the worst, and then we'll move up from there. Judas. Judas always was a man who had an eye toward money. Not to take care of it, not to look after it, but to have it. He loved money. He loved to line his pockets. Judas is an example for us of a bad leader, one who is seeking his own personal gain. Yet, he was one of the 12 that Christ originally called. Read with me John 12, 4 through 6. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Now here is one of the very 12, the original cast of characters, as it were, for the church. One of the original people who were set up to guide, direct the church once Christ was ascended into heaven. And here you have even one of the 12 being a bad leader. Being someone who is looking after selfish gain and not for the glory of God. Even within, numbered into the close-knit 12, you have a scoundrel. You say, well, that's a really good plug for the plurality of elders, Josh. What's worse is that the rest of them didn't even know it. They didn't even know it until after it was all over. After Jesus had been betrayed with a kiss. "You betray me with a kiss," he says to Judas. And all the disciples sit back and they just wonder, what's going on here? Jesus specifically tells John, "Listen, you want to know who it is that's going to betray me? Just as it was prophesied, the one who dips bread in the cup with me, that's the one." And then immediately he gets up and Jesus stops the Seder supper and he says, "Go quickly and do what you must do." And every one of them are sitting there like, "Oh, right on, he's probably procuring some food for something. Okay, that's great. See you later, Judas." Completely had them duped. I said, boy, that's a really good plug for a plurality. It kind of is. Because no matter how good the group of people you have, there might be someone there who shouldn't be there. And the mass, the people that are there might be deluded, might be confused, might be completely duped by that person. They might be as cunning as Judas. And so therefore, now of course we have a purpose. The purpose behind Judas's experience and his involvement there was so that the scriptures might be fulfilled, that even one of his inner circle would betray him. But without a plurality of spirit-filled men watching out, looking out, looking at each other, keeping each other accountable, asking hard questions, where's the money going? What's being done? You might end up with a Judas in your midst. Judas is the poster child for plurality of elders. So what if a church, what if our church had only a Judas and nobody else? Then that church, and I'll tell you what, there are plenty of churches that have one elder, and that elder is a Judas who lines his pockets with the church's money. I mean, there's a guy in Holly Hill who took all the church's money and bought a plane in Holly Hill several years ago. Had had homeless people join the church so that he could give them money and give them things and vote everybody else out of the church so that he could have the money. This happened in our locale. Made national news, as a matter of fact. A Judas. Second, we have Thaddeus. Have you ever know, you ever spend any time studying Thaddeus, anybody? Thaddeus, the man with three names, actually, is also known as Jude. Thaddeus, along with James the Less and Simon the Zealot, are all very obscure members of the disciples. In John MacArthur's book, 12 Ordinary Men, Thaddeus is discovered as being a rather tender-hearted, gentle man who displayed childlike humility with any interaction that was taking place. Now, MacArthur did an amazing job in that book pulling out every tiny little nugget everywhere throughout the Gospels and the New Testament to piece together some semblance of a character sketch of these people. Thaddeus was a little easier than some of the other ones that we'll see, but here we have a gentle person, a person of kind-heartedness that displayed childlike humility. Because Peter... Let me ask this question. Why is it that Thaddeus is relevant to our discussion? Well, not just because he's one of the 12, but because there is a Peter in the group as well. Where there is a childlike humility, it balanced Peter's incredibly salacious, extreme pride. Peter would say to Jesus the night that he would betray him, "I'll never let you go. I'll never betray. That will never happen." And in his pride, he fell. But there was a Thaddeus that balanced that. We don't know much about Thaddeus. We don't know a whole lot of what he said or what he did. But we do know that he was chosen by God to be one of these 12 men that would launch the church. If it was just Peter, if it was just James and John, the sons of thunder, it would not have the well-rounded understanding. Listen, the scriptures teach that elders are for the purpose of exemplifying the faith. If you only have me to follow, you're going to have a picture of faith that is skewed in one personality structure. If you don't have my personality, you might think, well, Jim and Josh, he's just this way, and I'm not this way, so he must be very faithful, and I must not be very faithful. That's why there's a Thaddeus, a humble person, quiet, soft-spoken. And that's why there's a Simon the Zealot, number three. We're kind of working up from the bottom here. Simon the Zealot. Simon is mentioned three times in the entirety of the whole of the New Testament. Each of these were only to really mention his name. And it mentioned him as the Zealot. The only clue that we have about this man is his party affiliation. He was very political before Christ called him. He was not a Sadducee or a Pharisee. Sadducees and Pharisees were of the priestly caste. They stood openly in public prayers. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the difference between the two was the Pharisees believed in the miraculous and the Sadducees did not. But they both had the same kind of basic perspective as far as the Messiah and who would be honored when the Messiah came, and it would be them. There was the Essenes, which were those who were kind of locked away in the ivory tower. They were the ones who huddled around the scriptures and tried to protect the scriptures and protect themselves and to be as holy as possible by setting themselves off. Holiness meant isolation. And there were the Zealots. The Zealots were those who believed that the Lord would come back and raise up an army and overrun the Romans and the whole world by force. Another zealot that you might not know of was Barabbas. His name was Jesus Barabbas, or Barabbas. And he was a zealot. He had killed a Roman officer, and that's why he was going to be crucified. But Simon here, Simon the Less, he's also understood as, Simon the Zealot was someone who had previously believed that the Messiah was going to come by force, by power, by might. And here comes Christ, and he says, come to me, and I'll make you zealous for better things, not for power and might, but for my kingdom, the kingdom that I will establish, not here on earth, but in heaven. Again, why does this matter? And I think it matters because elders can have all sorts of various positions on different political, economic, and social issues. Now, the zealots were understood as very violent and angry people. Now think about that. Think about this is one of the people that Christ called out of this zealous extremism to be one of his leaders. To be one of the men who would launch the Christian church. You have a Thaddeus, this humble guy, and standing right next to him is the zealot. That's wild. Normally, people who want leaders to come around them, to help them lead and launch something big, they're going to go out and find people that are very similar to them. They're going to try and find people that will just say what they say. Yes, men. Jesus didn't want yes men. He wanted people who caught the vision for what he was doing, believed wholeheartedly, and would be devoted servants. You can be a devoted servant as a Thaddeus. You can be a devoted servant as Simon the Zealot, one who had a past of this extreme view. We are going to take this world by force. But I'm going to tell you that the zealot was gone in Simon. Because to believe in Christ is not to believe that Jesus is coming to set up his kingdom on earth like this, by force. When Jesus was before Pilate, what did he say? Pilate asks him, he says, so are you a king? And he says, my kingdom is not of this world, or else my disciples would come and they would rise up and they would overthrow you. But my kingdom is not of this world. The zealot was done. Who was it that took out the sword and cut off Malchus's ear? It wasn't the zealot. It wasn't Simon. It was Peter. Simon had put down that armament. You would think Simon the zealot would be the one, but it wasn't. It was Simon Peter. James the Less. James the Less is probably the most obscure of all the disciples. In MacArthur's book, 12 Ordinary Men, MacArthur makes the assertion that this obscurity is most likely the distinguishing mark of James the Less's life. We see his name in a list, and we know that he was in the upper room after Christ's death. That's all we know. We see his name once, and then also in the upper room. So there we have just this very quick James the Less. Why would the Lord have such an obscure person in his list of disciples? Surely James the Less never did anything for the Lord, right? Wrong. He wasn't in front of anybody. He wouldn't stand out to anybody. He wasn't known even by history. He drifts off into the backdrop, and he started there, he stayed there, and he's been there ever since. Why would God not select 12 of the most charismatic, amazing speakers of his day. Wouldn't that be what we would do? Wouldn't we select the greatest, most accomplished, most... I mean, and isn't that what churches do? They call those from among them that are the most dynamic. Well, that's not the point. The point is not being dynamic. The point is not being... The point is being faithful. So maybe you're obscure. Maybe you would rather... You'd rather be in the background. That doesn't mean that God can't use you. It's actually the opposite. Because how many have we talked about so far, minus Judas? And we don't have a whole lot of detail about these guys. All of them are fairly obscure. Because the point of their life was not to make much of themselves, but to make much of Christ. James the Less was surely used by God. I have no doubt. His existence tells us something that our culture has taught us differently. The extroversion, being an extrovert, is not the only way to walk with the Lord. Introversion, being introverted, is not a sin. Being a homebody or being the life of the party, both are absolutely acceptable means of worship and service to God. And neither of those exclude the other from serving the Lord in any capacity whatsoever. If that were the case, then James the Less would not be a disciple, would not have been an apostle, would not have been an elder of sorts. The ones who are the most loud, most visible, they're not the ones that are, they're the leaders, and then everybody else are the followers. The quiet ones, well, they just need to be quiet and do their thing and then let room come for those who are boisterous. That's what our society wants to tell us. That if you are charismatic, you have charisma, and people want to follow you, you should be the leader. You won't find a more obscure leader in the list of disciples than James the Less. However, Christ still called him. He still trained him. He still commissioned him. And he gave him a charge over people. I've been thinking through this concept for a while now, for several weeks. Maybe even over the course of a month or two. And we have, as a Christian culture, the idea that if I come to church and I sit quietly and I don't really speak to anybody because that's just not my temperament, I'm not really walking with the Lord. Really, what you should be is you should fight and be an extrovert every chance you get. And as you look at people like James the Less, as you look at people like Thaddeus, the quiet, humble, and you realize that they most likely sat around with the 12 quietly in obscurity, not making waves like many Christians today do. That doesn't mean that they are in error for doing it. It means that's what God has made them to be. That's why there are extroverts and that's why there are introverts. So that the two don't, like, if everybody's an extrovert, we got a whole lot of chaos going on up in here. You know what I'm saying? That's not to say that you can just suck on green persimmons and sit there and, I'm an introvert, leave me alone. But rather, we ought to be who God has made us to be. I believe James the Less is one of those examples. There's a Zealot, there's a Peter, there's a Thaddeus, there's a James the Less. And then there's Thomas. Thomas. Thomas was also called Didymus. Ditto. Also called the twin, is what Didymus means, is the twin. You know, there's a lot of people that believe that he and Matthew were actually the twin brothers, that they looked similar. And so Matthew was more prominent, Thomas a little less. And so Matthew was Matthew and Thomas was Didymus. Hey, twinny, come over here. Yo, twin. And maybe it's not that. Maybe he was a twin with somebody else. But he was just known to be a twin. He was categorized that way. Thomas or Didymus could be considered almost as having a classic case of bipolar disorder. Wait, what? If you consider some of the things that we hear him say, which he doesn't say a lot, or we don't have a whole lot recorded, but there are certain things that he says that kind of make you think, where is this guy coming from? He's hot and then he's cold, and then he's hot and then he's cold. The last part of Christ's life here on earth, the last Passion Week or whatnot, leading up to it, you'll remember the story of Lazarus, Jesus' dear friend. And word had come, he's sick unto the point of death. And Jesus, he's being asked to come and heal him or just be there or whatever. And the disciples are all very concerned. They're like, listen, they've got spies out. They want to kill him. And what does Thomas say? Does anybody remember? That's right. Let's go. And we will all be killed with him. That is like extremism, man. That sounds like it should be coming from the Zealot, you know? But Thomas, like, we will die with you. Let's go into the fray, you know? And the next thing we find is that, okay, they did kill him. And what's Thomas doing?
I'm done.
And he leaves with the rest of them. Where is that? It's like a week later. Where's your fervor? Where's your excitement? Where's your willingness to die with Jesus? And he even goes so far as to say, as we classically known him to be doubting Thomas, he goes all the way to the extreme where he reports he's alive. He's risen from the dead. This is great news. And he's like, I don't believe it. And he goes into the depths of depression. But then when Christ arrives, what happens? He shows up in the room. He doesn't go through the door. The door is locked. And Jesus shows up in the room. And Thomas is there. And Jesus says, touch my hands. Put your fingers in my side. See. Come feel. But Thomas doesn't even need that. At that point, he's done. He's no more doubting. He's done. And he just falls to his knees and he cries out, my Lord and my God. You notice in the text, it never says he touched. It never says that he felt. All he did was fall down and worship. Leaders aren't what the world would tell us they are. True leaders, true shepherds of the flock, are various and have different personalities. They have different maladies. They have different problems and troubles and difficulties. Leaders, elders, shepherds can fall into depression. Do you know that? Charles Spurgeon was once put on suicide watch because of depression. John Bunyan was a manic, depressed person. Spent years at one point in his life trapped in a depression he could not get out of. It was said of Martin Luther that his manic and mania personality was so extreme, it was hard at times to even be around him. Ooh. The point is that these are men. They have problems. Jesus chose broken men. Broken people to serve his church. And to think that we could possibly elevate anybody that's broken is a failure. If you think for 2 seconds I'm not broken, by gum, talk to my wife. I'm broken. Those first five are very obscure, leading into a little less obscure Matthew, Nathaniel or Bartholomew, Philip, James and John, Peter and Andrew. Let's tackle those quickly. We're running out of time. Matthew was also known as Levi, who had become Matthew. He was like a customs official in Capernaum who taxed imports and exports based on his own personal judgment. This is who Matthew was. The Jews hated him because he worked for Rome. He was a traitor. He was viewed as a traitor, one who sold his fellow Jews up the river. Matthew put down the false weights and became a disciple of Christ, a leader in his church. God can take scoundrels and turn them into saints and use them. It doesn't matter your past. It doesn't matter the past of others. What matters is what Christ has done in and through you today and what he will do tomorrow. Your history, your past, what kind of scoundrel you may have been, doesn't matter. Not when it comes to the saving work of Christ. No matter what sin or what people may have thought or think of you, you can turn, like Matthew, away from your dishonest weights to serve the living God and be a cornerstone in his church. Nathanael or Bartholomew, he is a true Israelite in whom there is no deceit. You know, one of my favorite points in the Gospels is at this point, and I've thought about how I could preach this passage where Jesus is brought in by Philip to Bartholomew. Philip brings everybody to Jesus, brings Jesus to everybody. And so he comes in and he sees Nathanael or Bartholomew sitting there, and he says, "Behold, an Israelite in whom there is no guile, there is no deceit." And Nathanael's like, "How do you know?" And then Jesus says, "Because I saw you when you were sitting under the fig tree." And at that moment, the first declaration was uttered from the mouth of a human being, apart from Christ's birth, that he was the King of Israel. He said, You are the Son of God, the King of Israel. And he falls down and he worships Jesus and follows him until he dies. Nathanael didn't get much airtime, as it were, but in that moment, he knew who Jesus was. And you know, I've heard speculation over and over again, and my mind wants to drift to speculation as to what happened there. And I know we shouldn't, but it just in my mind, it's almost what many scholars think, and what I personally think as well, is that Nathanael must have been sitting under that fig tree at some point in the past, crying out for the Messiah to come. Please, God, come in the flesh, as you have said you would, be the one that we're longing for. And he's sitting under this fig tree. Apparently, maybe it's a long-standing thing that he always does. He always goes and sits under this one particular fig tree. Maybe that's what happens, and he's always crying out to God, please, please, God, please, God. And then Jesus shows up, and he says to him something that nobody should know, especially not some stranger. Under the fig tree, I saw you. And that word saw, okay, so I could like preach a whole sermon on it. It's just like my eyes were affixed upon you. I knew you. I saw you. I recognized you under the fig tree. And that was enough to explode Nathanael's heart in worship, praise, and adoration. Here we have a man who recognized Christ from the beginning. Whereas Matthew was a man who did not know Christ, who later in life, after so much evil, such treachery, God used that which was a pure vessel in whom there is no guile, and God used a broken vessel. And then we have Philip. Philip was not a dynamic speaker. But Philip was consistent. He just brought everybody to Christ. Philip was the one who brought Nathanael. He brought the Gentiles. So, you know, in that scene where they were all asking, he's like, okay, let me go get him. Hold on. You know, so he goes and gets Jesus, and then preaches to him. Philip was the one who brought the young boy with the fishes and the loaves. He brings people. He's bringing people to Christ. Come and sit at the Savior's feet. Here, I've got somebody you got to meet. You got to meet this guy. Although the ability to teach is one of the qualifications for being an elder, it doesn't say that if you're an elder, you must teach, but rather, when called on, you can. Regardless of that, I do believe that all leaders of Christ's church should, in one way or another, be about bringing people to Christ. Bringing people before the throne of God in whatever way possible. And then we have James and John, the sons of thunder. We're wrapping it up here. We've only got four guys left, and we'll deal with both of them in unison. Sons of thunder. They were outspoken. They were reckless. They were dangerous at times. They were obnoxious at times, lacking in patience, lacking in tact, sometimes even lacking in the ability to blush. Their mom shows up and says, hey, classic mom, right? I want my boy sitting at your right hand and your left hand, okay? The boldness, you know, only moms can do. Right, moms in the room? Now listen here. I want these two. They're good guys. They're my boys. Right? But what do? They're like, yeah, go for it, mom. You know, they're not like, mom, get back, get out of here. They're just like, well, what do you think, Jesus? No! No! The sons of thunder. Their dad's name was not thunder. It was an expression that these guys were loud, they're boisterous, they're rough and tumble. You know, they had a fishing company as brothers. Interestingly, James was the oldest of the two. But John was the one that the Holy Spirit allowed to designate as the one disciple that Jesus loved. Over and over and over again in the book of John. That's how John refers to himself. The one that Jesus loved. And maybe that sounds a little arrogant, especially considering the fact that he's one of the sons of thunder and the mom did the whole thing. But he's the one who sat closest to Christ, who leaned upon his breast at the Last Supper. All the other disciples asked him, hey, ask Jesus who's going to betray us or who's going to betray him. And John is the one who was able to get close enough to ask. James is the older brother. Just like James, Andrew is the older brother out of Andrew and Peter. They're brothers. And they had a fishing company as well. And the two fishing companies were probably joined together, partnered together in order to accomplish a greater end. But Andrew was also the older, and yet the younger outshined the older. So James could have been jealous. Andrew could have been jealous of his younger brothers or their younger brothers stepping up and being the mouthpiece like Peter or the one that Jesus loved, the one that would become the adopted son to his mother. I mean, these are massive things that are going on here, interplaying in this whole situation. And yet what we find in all of this is that the men that God chose were so various and so diverse. Honestly, it doesn't make any sense. You know, I had a job early on after my wife and I got married. And my wife was looking for a job. She got laid off from someplace, I think. The guy just didn't want to hire a husband and wife team because that gets sketchy quick, apparently. Real, real bad. And I was like, no, we're different. We're different, you know. Eventually, he would hire her, and we were different. We only yelled in the car. No, just kidding. We didn't yell in the car. Yelled at the house. No, just kidding. Again, no yelling. But the idea of hiring two brothers for anybody, especially loud sons of thunder-like brothers, or like Peter, who is so bold and brash, would put everybody off. That's not going to happen. Oh, your brother wants a job? Put him in the warehouse. You know, you're not coming in here. You guys aren't sitting at a desk together. No, not going to happen. Why? Sibling rivalry, this and that. Jesus enters into that fray and he raises up these different men to use them in all these different ways. Now, we've said much about Peter already, but he was the chief mouthpiece. When it came to the Jerusalem Council, he and James were the ones who spoke. James was the elder of the church of Jerusalem. Wasn't even one of the disciples. It was James, Jesus' brother, half-brother. Peter was the chief speaker. It's not that none of the other ones taught or spoke. It's just he was the one that Christ saw as being the one who would step up and who would even lead the 12. It's not a chief among equals concept. That's not at all. They all had the same level of authority, but the giftedness of Thaddeus was not the same giftedness of Peter. But they balanced each other. James and John and Andrew and all of these men, they didn't have the same giftedness. They looked different. They sounded different. They talked different. They even taught people in different ways. And that was the beauty of it. they weren't all just yes men for Christ.
Now, they were yes men because Christ was right, so he's always yes men. But
that they weren't just that typical cookie cutter, Jesus looks like this, and so I'm going to make sure that everybody has the same complexion, the same personality, the same tone, the same. I'm going to choose Bartholomew or Nathaniel. I'm going to choose Thaddeus, and I'm also going to choose the Sons of Thunder and Peter. And then later I'll choose Paul, who is so quiet in personality that people said, well, he's not even an apostle. Where's his fire? But yet when he was preaching and teaching, between him and Barnabas, they called him Hermes because he was the chief speaker. He spoke prolifically, and they called Barnabas Zeus, you know? It takes variation to give us a well-rounded picture of the faith that we ought to emulate. So why plurality? Why? Because one person does not have a corner on the perfect example of faith. Let me say that again. One person or another person or another person is not the perfect example of faith. You have to be able to take some from here, take others from here and here and here. And what that essentially means is that there's deficiencies in every leader, and the more plurality, the safer the flock. The more diversity, the safer the sheep. Let's pray together.